Well, 2 weeks ago, I started talking about hope. And in particular, what I've been talking about is Jesus' radical countercultural message of hope. It's a message of hope that is just hard to receive because it runs so against the counter of the culture of his day as well as the culture of our day. The first week, we looked at three different stories with people that were all in a desperate situation and without hope. But Jesus came and not only gave them hope and gave them a message that was completely counter to the culture of their day, but his message was not one of warm thoughts and wishful thinking. Because in each and every case, he also came with action and with power to either heal, to raise the dead, or to set free. Last week we looked at two stories. One, the crippled man at the pool of Bethesda in John 5. A man who would have had no hope. But we looked at how this man quickly made excuses for why he couldn't get healed. Someone always gets into the pool before me, and there's no one to help me. And it didn't matter to Jesus. He brought that man a message of hope and healing anyway. Then we also looked at the story of Zacchaeus last week, which was a little bit different because it didn't involve a healing, but rather Zacchaeus was a social outcast. And not the normal kind of social outcast because he's a leper or a prostitute or something like that. But Zacchaeus was a wealthy man. But we explained how his wealth made him a social outcast. But that didn't matter to Jesus. He still brought that radical message of hope to Zacchaeus, and Zacchaeus got saved that day. Today I want to look at another story, but this story has a different twist to it again. I want to look at the story in Luke 8, starting in verse 41. If you have one of the green sheets, it's on there. If you didn't grab a green sheet, there's some on the back table. Wave your hand and someone will get one to you. But this is the story in Luke 8, starting in verse 41, the story of a man named Jairus. It says this, "Then a man named Jairus, a ruler of the synagogue, came and fell at Jesus' feet, pleading with him, come to his house, because his only daughter, a girl of about 12 was dying. As Jesus was on his way, the crowds almost crushed him. And a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years, but no one could help her. She came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak, and immediately her bleeding stopped. Who touched me? Jesus asked. When they all denied it, Peter said, Master, the people are crowding and pressing against you. But Jesus said, Someone touched me. I know that power has gone out from me. Then the woman, seeing that she could not go unnoticed, came trembling and fell at his feet in the presence of all the people. She told why she had touched him and how she had been instantly healed. Then he said to her, Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace. While Jesus was still speaking, someone came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler. Your daughter is dead, he said. Don't bother the teacher anymore. Hearing this, Jesus said to Jairus, Don't be afraid, just believe, and she will be healed. When he arrived at the house of Jairus, he did not let anyone go in with him except Peter, John, and James, and the child's father and mother. Meanwhile, all the people were wailing and mourning for her. Stop wailing, Jesus said. She is not dead, but asleep. They laughed at him, knowing that she was dead. But he took her by the hand and said, My child, get up. This is a different kind of story than the ones we've looked at so far because there's two stories intertwined. There's two desperate people, two desperate situations, and they're all intertwined. And so we have to look at that and how they work together. The first character we see is this Jairus, who is identified as a synagogue ruler. Most likely he was the main key leader in the local synagogue. But for sure, Jairus was a man of standing in this city. And in the book of Luke, he's the first person, the first religious leader to respond favorably to Jesus. Sometimes desperate situations cause us to do desperate things. It took the death of his daughter to get a religious leader to part from the culture of the other religious leaders and to come to Jesus and fall at his feet. So just like all the other stories we've looked at, here is a desperate person in a desperate situation. It goes on to tell us that it was his only daughter and that she was 12 years old. In this time and age, 12, the girl would have been just about marriageable age. She was sort of coming into the prime of her life. This would have been devastating for this family. But what's interesting here is the verb structure, dying, in the Greek. It says that she is beginning to die. The process of dying has begun. So Jesus agrees to go, but it says that the crowds are pressing in on him. And this is what I thought was really cool. The verb, pressing in, it's the same verb used in the previous passage in Luke in the parable of the seeds when it describes the thorns pressing in and choking the good seed. So it's that same picture. The weeds pressing in and choking the good seed, that's the same picture here. The crowds are pressing in against Jesus. And then verse 33, there's an interruption. All of a sudden, in the middle of the story, it's now interrupted by another desperate person in another desperate situation. A woman with a flow of blood that she has suffered with for 12 years. This would have made her continuously unclean and would have been the source of continual embarrassment. This would have completely affected her ability to live a normal life. Anyone else who touched her would have become unclean, which means that she probably would have lost her husband and her children. She was all alone, a social outcast, but of a different kind. She also would not have been allowed to go to the temple. Remember one of the previous stories we looked at 2 weeks ago, the woman was already in the temple. So she was already seeking a religious answer to her problem. But this woman couldn't do that. Because of her uncleanness, she would not have been allowed in the temple. The book of Mark also mentions in the parallel story that she had spent all her money on doctors, so she was probably poor and broke. Luke says that no one could help her. But this means that she is without hope. Her money is gone. Her family is gone. No one will have contact with her. No one would have touched this woman in 12 years. No hugs. No touches. No contact. This was a woman in a desperate situation and without hope. But because she's unclean, she devises a plan and she sneaks up behind Jesus and she touches him. You see, she was afraid that if Jesus saw her coming, that he would reject her too, because that was the message her culture said loud and clear. So she comes up and she touched the edge of his cloak, and immediately her bleeding stopped. Now, what makes this story unique is with all the other ones, Jesus was actively involved. I have made the point in every story we've looked at so far that Jesus noticed the person. Whether it was Zacchaeus in the tree or the beggar by the pool, it says Jesus noticed that person. Here, Jesus doesn't see the person. And in all of those other stories, Jesus then instigates the healing. He either touches the person or says something to begin the healing process. With the blind man, there was a big element of faith. He says, okay, now go wash in the pool. But here, Jesus doesn't do anything. The woman simply comes up and touches him. You see, because sometimes hope and healing simply comes when we, in faith, reach out and touch Jesus. But Jesus asks, who touched me? This is interesting because remember, the crowds are pressing in on him as if they were choking him. Jesus probably already knew who had touched him, right? But he was looking for her to make a confession. He wasn't looking for her to make a confession so that he could further embarrass her or to pour on more shame that she was so accustomed to getting from the culture. No, Jesus looked for her to make a confession so that he could affirm her, that he could affirm her faith. Then it says that the woman, seeing that she could not go unnoticed, came trembling at his feet. The word for trembling here is the word that's associated with fear. Certainly, she had just cause to be full of fear. Her culture had ingrained that. And the culture had told her, you have no hope. But Jesus responds differently. He said to her, daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace. Rather than rejection or embarrassment, which is, I'm sure, what she was expecting, Jesus blesses her. This was completely countercultural. This is that radical countercultural message of hope. The crowds would have expected Jesus to have been angry with her. For according to their customs, he is now unclean as well. Jesus rather confirms that it was her faith that healed her. He responds with grace and mercy and healing and, of course, hope. But hope rooted in her faith, the simple faith just to reach out and touch his garment. She now has hope. She has hope that her life can be different. But what's even cooler is he says, your faith has healed you. But as we looked at 2 weeks ago, this word healed in Greek is also the same word for saved. And the last time we saw, he said, your faith has saved you. This time he says, your faith has healed you. It's the same word. The concepts of healing and salvation are the same. It's only in our Western culture that we've separated them. So Jesus affirms her and says, your faith has healed you and saved you. Wow, what a radically different message than what the culture around her would have told her. But then he goes even one step farther and he blesses her with peace. He sends her away with a blessing of peace. The crowds would have wanted to have sent her away scandalized. But wait a minute. Wasn't this a story about Jairus and his daughter? What happened to him? Verse 49 says, while Jesus was still speaking, someone came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler. Your daughter is dead. Don't bother the teacher anymore. This delay caused by healing the woman appears to have been extremely costly for Jairus' daughter. The envoy from the synagogue leader seems to convey that all hope is lost. What was a desperate situation has now become incredibly desperate and incredibly without hope. What's interesting here, though, is that while she was in the process of dying, they had the faith to come and ask Jesus for healing. But now that she's dead, their faith appears to have disappeared. And yet these same envoys that have just come to deliver the message probably saw the commotion, and they probably heard what had just happened to the woman who had been healed of bleeding for 12 years. You see, in their culture, dead was dead. It didn't matter that this woman had just been healed of 12 years of bleeding. It didn't matter all of the other stories that they had heard of Jesus. This girl was now dead. Don't bother him anymore. The culture would have given a message of no hope. But could Jesus possibly have set himself up for a better opportunity to display his countercultural message of hope? But there's also something going on here. How is Jairus going to respond to all of this? This was certainly an opportunity for jealousy, don't you think? Jairus could have said, I asked first. If only Jesus hadn't stopped for this woman. After all, she'd already been sick for 12 years. What's a few more days? Now my daughter is dead. It could have led Jairus to ask, where is my hope? Did you run out with this woman? Is there no more for me? Did he forget that I'm here still waiting for him to come to my house? Why did he have to become so interrupted by this other woman? Have you been there? Have you been in that place in your own spiritual journey where it just feels like somewhere along the way Jesus forgot to follow you? Because we're supposed to be following him. right? But I think we all get there. But this goes back to what I talked about last week. Our view of Christ and his cross is too small. If for 1 minute I think to myself, oh no, because he stopped for this woman, I have lost all hope. I've just made Jesus' cross really small. And I'm saying that his cross isn't big enough for the both of us. He healed this woman, and so now I'm just out of luck. We think that, don't we? But when we do, we've diminished the size of Christ's cross. But continuing in verse 50, hearing this, Jesus said to Jairus, "Don't be afraid, just believe, and she will be healed." He says something that is completely out of line with the culture of the day, and it's certainly not what people would have expected. But he gives Jairus a message of hope. A message of hope that seemed ridiculous. You see, the crowds were probably already beginning to plan a funeral. The professional mourners were already lining up. If Jairus was a man of wealth, if he was a man of standing, he had the money to hire mourners. And so some of them are already getting in line, hoping to get a job mourning for his daughter. But how would Jairus respond? Because as Jesus delivers this message of hope, Jairus now has to respond, doesn't he? He could say, "Ah, whatever, I'm going home." Can he get over his disappointment? Can he get past his unmet expectations? He had a mental picture of what it would look like for Jesus to come to his house. We all do that. When we ask Jesus for something, we have a mental picture of what we think it's going to look like. And then when he does something different, we're like, oh. Can he get past his unmet expectations? Can he still hope against all odds? Well, it tells us that the whole crowd, everyone goes to Jairus' house, but only Jesus only lets the inner circle, Peter, James, and John, and the child's parents in. We talked about this last week. It's not weird. It's not a creeper thing when the whole crowd goes with you. That's what they did. Everybody else would have stood outside and peered in the doors and windows to see what was going on. That's just what they did. Verses 52 and 53 say, "Meanwhile, all the people were wailing and mourning for her." "Stop wailing," Jesus said. "She is not dead, but asleep." They laughed at him, knowing that she was dead. Because of the presence of these mourners, we know for sure that the child has been pronounced dead, and the whole village knows of the death. Remember, I talked about 2 weeks ago how important mourning was in their culture. They understood mourning in a better way than we do. But they would have wept and wailed and made all kinds of noise. And again, they would have hired women to wail at these funerals. And the more people wailing, the better. So there would have been professional mourners there wailing. But Jesus says, "Stop it. Stop all this wailing." What a countercultural message. One that the crowd just seemed to find ridiculous. They could see no hope. All they could see was the dead corpse of a 12-year-old girl. Sometimes Jesus' countercultural message of hope is really hard to receive, isn't it? Because the evidence is before us. I see with my eyes the thing before me that is dead. How can I have hope? The crowd begins to mock Jesus. They're laughing at him. Which I think is interesting, how quickly they can go from mourning to laughing. Which shows you that there were professional mourners there. And they thought that Jesus was honing in on their gig. Because if they couldn't weep and wail, they wouldn't get paid. But all they can do is firmly state what they know to be true. She's dead. Inside the house, it says that Jesus came to the girl, took hold of her hand, and just says, "Get up." And of course she does. Because remember, Jesus' message of hope is not one of warm thoughts and wishful thinking. When that envoy came to Jairus and said, "Don't bother the teacher anymore, your daughter is dead," and Jesus says, "Just have faith," he wasn't handing her a greeting sympathy card. He was handing her real, tangible hope. that if you trust, if you can get past your disappointment, that I will come and I will raise your daughter. And so he comes to this house this day, he takes her by the hand, and she gets up. This is a scene of hope upon hope. He not only can raise the dead, he shows that he is not too busy. Man, have you ever gotten hit with that one? Jesus must just be too busy to worry about little old me. But his cross and his message of hope are so radically huge that he sees everything about little old you. And he will come touch the dead things in your life. He shows that he is not forgotten. When he stopped to heal the woman with the bleeding, he did not forget. What looked like a delay, what looked like Jesus got there too late, was nothing of the sort. Because his cross is so big, it doesn't matter when he gets there. He could have showed up 2 weeks later and told that little girl, get up, and she would have got up. Jesus is never late. His cross is that big. The work of his cross is big enough to heal both the woman with the bleeding and Jairus' daughter. The healing of Jairus' daughter just didn't look like what he thought it would. Well, sometimes when we are waiting for our hope, it appears as if there's been a delay. God, where are you? When are you going to come? Have you forgotten me? But it is never because Jesus' cross isn't big enough. But there will be a question of how we respond during the delay. Can we get over our disappointments and our unmet expectations? Now I want to look at one more story. This is in John 8. John 8, starting in verse 3. It says this: the teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now what do you say?" They were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "If any one of you is without sin, let him be the first to throw the stone at her." Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left with the woman standing there. Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Now go and leave your life of sin." Here's another radical message of hope, but in a completely different way. The religious leaders of the day bring this woman they claim they caught in the act of adultery. Now, don't you have to stop right there and just ask the question, huh, I wonder how they caught her? Huh. But of course, the religious leaders weren't looking to do the right thing. They were looking to trap Jesus. And of course, they were doing this at the expense of the woman. Unlike the others that we've looked at where Jesus first noticed the person, here the people come to Jesus. They're coming to look for Jesus, but they're looking for trouble. But Jesus turns even this fiendish attempt at trouble into a message of hope. Isn't that crazy? Even when others were looking to make trouble, Jesus just turns it into a message of hope. This woman, just like the others, is a desperate person in a desperate situation. But she doesn't need physical healing. She needs saving from religious judgmentalism. But now we need to ask the question, are their claims true? A close examination of both the Old Testament and the extra-biblical writings of the day show that the law they claim to be following either doesn't exist or they weren't following it correctly. The law that they were most likely alluding to is found in Deuteronomy 22:22, which says this: "If a man is found sleeping with another man's wife, both the man who slept with her and the woman must die. You must purge the evil from Israel. If a man happens to meet in a town a virgin pledged to be married and he sleeps with her, you shall take both of them to the gate of that town and stone them to death. The girl, because she was in a town and did not scream for help, and the man, because he violated another man's wife. You must purge the evil from among you. This is the closest law that we can find that these Pharisees might have been alluding to. But in both of these cases, it says both the man and the woman were to be put to death. So in this scene here in John, where's the man? Now, in many places around the world today, blame for adultery is put fully on the woman. Is that what's going on here? Some sort of a chauvinistic garbage? Well, that certainly isn't what God's word prescribes. And it is only in one of these cases where stoning is prescribed. The other one, it just says put him to death. So the law that these religious leaders claim to be following doesn't seem to exist, or at least they're not following it accurately. But this was the culture of the day. This was the culture this woman was facing, and this was the culture that Jesus was up against. This was the culture that they were looking to use to trap him. Notice they're not looking to use the law to trap Jesus. They're looking to use culture to trap Jesus because the law, as they say it, doesn't exist. But how? Let's look at how Jesus brilliantly avoids their trap. He responds with a message of hope for the woman. This was not what she was thinking she was going to hear. It says, when they kept questioning him, he straightened up and he said to them, if any one of you is without sin, let him be the first to throw the stone. So in other words, he's pointing out their incorrect application of the law. His message, however, does have a strange sense of condemnation for those who cannot see grace and mercy, though, doesn't it? For the religious leaders who could not get, who could not understand grace and mercy, ultimately they are the ones who feel condemned and they leave. If they had understood who Jesus was, if they had understood mercy, they would have fallen at his feet. But it simply says they turned and they went, which meant they felt condemned. You see, if you have no room for grace and you fail to understand mercy, then Jesus' countercultural message of hope becomes one of condemnation. Verse 9 says, at this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus and the woman were left. I think at least a few of them went away angry too. Probably the younger ones, the ones that stayed the longest, because they just couldn't accept this message. In their youth, in that youthful aggression, they wanted to see the law fulfilled. Let's kill this woman. They knew Jesus would present only grace. But in the face of the hope that he brought, they had to turn and go. Jesus straightens up and asks the woman, where are they? Jesus brings hope to this woman by pointing out that when the law is applied properly, she has no accusers. This is a lesson for all of us. There is no one without sin, and therefore no one with the right to judge my sin. Only Jesus gets to judge our sin. The Bible does call for accountability within the church, but that's a far cry from the one-sided judgmentalism we see here in this passage, and that of which many of us may have experienced at the hands of other Christians. But the woman says, no, sir, there's no one. And then Jesus says, then neither do I condemn you. His counterculture message of hope comes to its full. Jesus says he doesn't condemn her. This was a message completely different from the culture and the religious leaders. This was not what she was expecting. But this is good news for all of us. You see, it doesn't matter what we've done in our past. It doesn't matter what other people say or think about us or have said about us. This is between us and Jesus. And Jesus does not condemn you. He does tell her and us to go and leave our life of sin. There is a call to holiness, but in Christ there is no condemnation because Jesus took that at the cross. Every ounce of condemnation that was meant for us, Jesus took on the cross. There is no condemnation left, only grace and mercy and hope and healing. This is a radical message of hope that stands against everything the world around us would try to tell us. But so often there is that temptation in us to try to condemn others. And again, when we do that, what we're saying is, your cross isn't big enough for the both of us. I'm going to take every last ounce of grace for me, and you don't get any. That is the message we send when we try to condemn someone else. But certainly that's the culture around us. That's what the culture tries to tell us. Or the culture around us tries to promote cheap grace. Everything's acceptable, and there's really no need for Jesus. It's just all good. No, there really is. There really is sin. He took the condemnation on the cross and left an incredibly wide wake of mercy and grace for us to walk in. Today we're also going to observe communion. And when you think about it, this is an incredibly countercultural message of hope as well. Because in this simple meal, Jesus says, if you drink my blood and eat my body, I will set you free. Where do you hear that kind of message in the world? But as we eat this simple meal, we're reminded that there is no condemnation in Christ. This simple meal reminds us that the cross is big enough for everyone. As you look around this room, we are all in equal need of this table. Don't let the enemy tell you that you need it more. And don't let the enemy tell you that you need it less. This simple meal is a radical message of hope that you can be completely set free if in faith you reach out and you touch Jesus. On the night that Jesus was betrayed, he took bread, and after giving thanks, he broke it. And he said, this is my body, broken for you. Whenever you eat this, do it in remembrance of me. And in the same way, after the meal, he took the cup. And after giving thanks, he said, this is my blood, poured out for you. This is a new covenant. Remember, covenants were always signed and sealed with blood. This is a new covenant. Whenever you drink this, do this in remembrance of me. As you come here today, remember the message of hope that comes in this table. It is a crazy, countercultural message of hope. The way we do communion here, we have two stations, one here and one in the back. You'll come up, you'll take a piece of the bread, you'll dip it into the juice, and receive them together. And all who profess Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior are welcome to join us at this table. You do not have to be a member of our church. You just have to profess Christ as Lord and Savior. If you're coming up to the front one, please come down this side of the aisle and then go return to your seat through this side of the aisle. We used to have you go through this way, but there's a monitor for the worship team up here, and they kind of need to hear what they're doing. But there's also a station in the back, too, so you can go to either one. But the worship team is going to lead us into a little time of additional worship. And as you prepare your hearts, just come on up and receive communion.